Playback on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Dublin Airport's Platinum VIP Terminal. Experience private check-in, suites for relaxation, and then chauffeur-driven to your aircraft.
Good morning. All eyes on the turkeys, and yes, the chickens and the ducks too. Because from next Monday, it's a poultry lockdown, all because of the risk of infection from bird flu. Philip Boucher-Hay spoke to farmer and journalist Darren McCullough.
No outbreaks in commercial properties since February 2023, and now two in close succession. It looks like it's getting harder to keep out.
Yeah, it's we're getting to the point where people are beginning to wonder if bird flu is going to become endemic. And what we're seeing, like I have only a very small flock of hens at home here on the farm, but what we're seeing every year is that effectively there's a lockdown every year. And the only thing that changes is it seems to be happening a bit earlier year after year. And I suppose that's maybe linked to climate change, the fact that, you know, the increase in temperatures and allowing diseases like this to move faster and get into the system. Normally we'd rely on the cold to keep it out, but yeah, that's not happening this year anyway.
And for a reminder as to just what farmers are up against, here's agriculture correspondent Angus Cox on Morning Ireland.
It's actually from the same family as human flu viruses, but obviously it mainly affects birds, especially wild birds such as ducks and geese, as well as domestic poultry like chickens and also turkeys that we've seen in recent days. In Ireland, it's mainly being spread by wild birds. At the moment, much of continental Europe and the UK are seeing significant bird flu outbreaks, far worse than what we've seen here. And it's wild birds migrating to Ireland who can carry the virus that are the big risk. And it's spread the same way most viruses are, direct contact with infected birds via contaminated surfaces and saliva or droppings. And if a bird contracts bird flu, it will likely get extremely sick and die. And interestingly, with previous strains of bird flu, infected birds, they are observed to be dying quite quickly within 24 hours. But it's reported the latest strain, the highly pathogenic H5N1 bird flu, that it's taking up to 72 hours to kill birds. And obviously that's a worry because it gives more time then for the virus to spread to other birds.
And even if you do keep the flock in with the best will in the world, it might not work. Back to Dara.
I was talking to a turkey producer last night, and he has a free range flock, but he's kept them in for the last number of weeks. And he's just terrified that, you know, someday he'll go down and he'll see one or two sick birds. And that evening he'll see 10 or 15, and the next morning he's got 20 dead. And at that point, if you get bird flu in your house, you have to notify the authorities, and then a whole process, it's all taken out of your hands, your entire flock is gassed on the spot. Like, these are animals, creatures that you've cared for since the day they were hatched, you know, when they were little helpless chicks, and you've nursed them along, and if you're a turkey producer, Christmas is your harvest, and to see that all wiped out and be completely out of your control is heartbreaking stuff. He's got three more weeks before those birds are fit for slaughter. And so, like, you know, he'll be on tenterhooks for the next 3.5 weeks, hoping and praying that he can keep his flock safe. But there's no guarantees for him.
Something turkey farmer Robert Fitzsimmons knows all too well. He spoke to Gavin on Morning Ireland.
The Irish Independent is reporting this morning that Christmas turkeys might have to be slaughtered earlier, and so they could be smaller. What do you think?
Look, each case in different parts of the country could be different. Here, as soon as we get them to the weight that we deserve, we're going to try and go. But it's not that simple to change, because the age of the birds, you know, we're set up to do this with years and years. And it's difficult just to change because something comes and throws a span on the works.
But you might have to go earlier, yes?
Yes, we may have to go earlier this year.
And do you think there could be a shortage this Christmas?
If this gets worse, it could be very, very serious. If this gets in even outside of turkeys, we're all hell-bent on turkeys because that's where it's stuck up a dog in the head right now. But if this gets into like a broiler breeder, it could be very serious for the food chain.
Oh, perish the thought. Lock up those birds. For morning, Ireland. Meanwhile, in Brazil, world leaders gathered ahead of COP30. Among them, speaking in Belém, Taoiseach Micheál Martin.
Conflict and dislocation all have been presented as reasons to ease or delay action. But increasingly, the challenges we face arise because of climate change, and this will worsen with time. At a time when political leadership has never been more vital, there are fewer of us here in Belém, fewer leaders ready to tell it as it is. Climate change is unarguable. The science is undeniable. Temperatures are rising and the clock is ticking.
And it may well be, but not everyone got the memo on the urgency. There were some notable no-shows. On yesterday's News at One, here's environment correspondent George Lee.
The leaders who are here are disappointed, obviously, that there are not more of them here. And the reason for that is because, I guess, the United States' position in relation to climate has really challenged them. And that's one of the things they have in the background here. And Micheál Martin yesterday was very clear and open about it. He said, the reason why I'm here is because the US and others aren't here. And in doing that, he's underlining the most important thing, I think, in terms of those such as the European politicians and certainly the European Union are concerned, is that they will not give up on this in fight for climate action just because it looks as if the tide is going out in some countries and in the United States and so on. So in terms of political tone, I think that's very strong from the leaders here who are here, and particularly from the European Union. Just like all of those young people, they're aware that people are critical of these COP negotiations and have often been. But they're saying it's very difficult to get agreement among all these countries. But by God, given that so many people are beginning to unwind the whole notion of multilateral advances in terms of climate action and addressing this issue and denying the science, well, we're not going to do that. It's really important we stick together. We've got to get a strong result out of this COP. We are here for that reason, and putting it up to the others who aren't here to basically say we're not going to cave in yet. So I would say the scepticism that a lot of the young people are talking about there, a talking shop and stuff like that, it must be so frustrating looking at it now. That was the situation before the US pulled out, before the attendance of all of the leaders began to dwindle a little bit. So it would be really frustrating. So that's one of the big, big pressures here, to make sure they do something.
The head of the UN's World Meteorological Organization has said that it's now virtually impossible to stick to the Paris Agreement to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees. And we're all experiencing the very real consequences of this.
Global warming will go above 1.5 degrees Celsius very early in the next decade, in the about 2030 or thereabouts. And if more efforts aren't made, we will go above 2% by 2048. Absolutely catastrophic. It sounds like, oh, well, that's only a little bit more. But every fraction of a degree means you're going to have more of those hurricanes such as you had this year in Jamaica, more of that flooding that you had in Valencia last year, more of Storm Eowyn's, and much, much more. So it really, really matters. And so you look at the rising sea levels, you look at the pace at which they're rising, you look at the impact for island states, all of that. So there's nothing has unwound. In fact, it has accelerated in terms of the alarm bells. You know, the vital signs of the Earth as they measure them are all flashing red, according to some reports. That's the way they put it. And we all know it ourselves. I mean, you can look around and you can see it on our news every week, every day. You see disaster stories in relation to weather and impact and rising sea levels and declining ice levels and so on all over the world. It is not going away, no matter what happens in the United States with the Trump administration.
No doubt more on this next week. Now, though, a complete change swiveled the brain this way.
Oh, he's not. He's a very naughty boy.
A real-life python, Michael Palin, joined Dermot yesterday, and he could not have been lovelier. Now, he was there to talk about his book and travel series on Venezuela, and while he's not a man to pull the do-you-know-who-I-am lark, he did tell this story.
There is a moment in the second episode where the authorities catch up with you and all your bag and baggage are put out onto the road. Tell us about that experience and how did you get out of it?
Well, we were stopped from filming for some reason in Hugo Chavez's birthplace. And eventually, well, we weren't just stopped by the local police, we were stopped by the intelligence agency, and they come along and they've got black uniforms, they've got bulletproof jackets, they've got assault rifles, night vision goggles, all this for us, you know. And they, anyway, they inspected all our bags, photographed everything, and then said, you can't film, you've got to stay till we get instructions. So we ended up in having some food in a nearby restaurant. And the men with guns were on one table and we were on the other. And it was really kind of totally surreal. Mm. And one of the guys, the paramilitary, said, you know, who is this man? So they said, oh, he's Michael Palin. He's a comedian. So he then looks me up on YouTube. And what they get, what they find on YouTube, is John Cleese and myself debating, or rather having a very strong argument with the Bishop of Southwark and Malcolm Muggeridge about the life of Brian back in 1979. And they they look very, very weird, these guys frowning and say, he's not funny, not really funny. So I said, well, show them Monty Python. So then again, they try and tap in Monty Python and they got the fish slapping dance, which is where I hit John with a couple of pilchards several times. He knocks me into the canal. And then you could just see that their rifles sort of shaking and their night vision goggles clouding up as they enjoyed it. So I felt we'd won a battle there. They realised we were not dangerous people. I was an extremely silly person.
Yes, unless you're armed with a fish, in which case you could be.
Yeah.
Oh, and because Troy has, he might, all the diaries, the travel shows, had the life. It just has to come back to this.
Did you say ex-leper?
That's right, sir. 16 years behind a bell, I'm proud of it, sir.
Well, what happened?
Oh, cured, sir.
Cured?
Yes, a bloody miracle, sir. God bless you.
Well, who cured you?
Jesus did, sir. I was hopping along, minding my own business. All of a sudden, up he comes, cures me. One minute I'm a leper with a trade, next minute my livelihood's gone. Not so much as a by your leave.
You're cured, mate.
Bloody do-gooder.
Well, why don't you go and tell him that you want to be a leper again?
Oh, I could do that, sir, yeah. Yeah, I could do that, I suppose. What I was thinking, I was going to ask him if he'd make me a bit lame in one leg during the middle of the week. You know, something beggable but not leprosy, which is a pain in the ass, to be blunt. Excuse my French, sir.
It's good writing there. That's John Cleese and Graham Chapman.
Yeah, but wrote that. Yeah. The writing is very good. However, it's your movement. During the whole thing, you're bouncing around. You're skipping and moving. And when I look at that, I kind of see that as a metaphor for your journey through life. That's how you navigate life in my head. This sort of gentle, curious bounce, playfulness.
Yes. Total bizarre, unreasonable optimism as he goes bashing around.
Oh, the most quotable of films. But he did give us an insight into certain scenes that did not make the cut.
Was there a sketch that was meant to go into the life of Brian about the Last Supper?
Yes, there was. I mean, this is when we were trying to work out how do we approach the Bible story in terms of sort of comedy. And we realised it had to be authentic. We actually did our research and found that there was a Messiah fever in the Bethlehem and Judea at that time. But there were other ideas that we thought would be so funny. And one was that St. Peter was trying to book a table for the Last Supper. And he rings up the restaurant and the guy just says, what, am I 12 on a Friday? You must be joking. Well, any other day? Well, I'll do your Thursday, but three tables of four. No, we want to be all at the same table. Mate, you haven't realised. I'll do your Monday, all right? Got a table on Monday. Oh, yes, and we all want to sit on the same side. I'm sorry, health and safety, can't do that. Which was very silly, but wasn't right for the film in the end. You know, we couldn't have argued that against the bishop.
Michael Palin with Dermot. Back in a bit. Welcome back. This week saw DJ Carey jailed for 5.5 years for defrauding people by falsely claiming he had cancer and needed money for treatment. On Liveline, a lot of reaction, particularly from those with cancer or who had lost loved ones to the disease.
Can you ever forgive or understand somebody who lied about having cancer?
In a word, John, no. Not ever. I don't have it in my heart to forgive anyone, don't mind DJ Carey, for lying about having cancer because, you know, I'm a cancer sufferer myself. I don't think there is anything much lower than lying about cancer, whether it's to get money out of people or not. There are certain things are a no-no. Lying about cancer is one of them.
You're angry about this case?
I've been very angry, John, since I found out about it in November 2023. And that was a month after I started hormone treatment for Gleason score 9, high grade aggressive inoperable prostate cancer with no symptoms.
I feel angry and shocked, and you know, just read all. My husband had a diagnosis of cancer in 2011. I couldn't even say the word cancer for a year. You know, I mean, this is like the whole family gets hit by a bus that is the diagnosis of cancer. And for somebody to, you know, go out and willingly lie about something, it just pulls the rug from under the people who are suffering from cancer and all their families. The hurt is huge.
It's appalling. It's so insulting to anybody that has walked the journey of a cancer diagnosis. He has no idea, because he hasn't been through cancer himself, of how difficult, how traumatizing, the effects that it leaves, and that there are so many people out there that have fought it, that are fighting it, but also it is so insulting because so many of us have lost special people to it. And I just feel infuriated by it all, to be honest.
Just some of the voices who phoned in to John Cook. Margaret Kerwin is in Kilkenny, and she was one of the people who had donated to the former Kilkenny Hurlers Cancer Fund.
Your name was mentioned in court. Your statements have been given in court. You gave statements to the Gardaí because you lent DJ Carey €4,000.
Actually, it was €5,000.
I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah.
And how do you want to tell us how that came about, Margaret?
Well, I'll do it very briefly. I was diagnosed with cancer. A very short time after that, DJ Carey approached my husband on the pitch to sympathise and asked if he could help. He also informed my husband on the first meeting that he had the same cancer that I had. My husband believed that DJ Carey had the same cancer as me, which it was a very early stage of our cancer journey. It was a very stressful time for us. And he was giving, you know, my husband, I suppose, hope, because he had told he had had it for 10 years at that stage. My husband had been Googling my cancer and was very worried internally, which I didn't, but, you know, speaking to DJ, he felt, you know, he's okay, so, you know, you'll be fine, Margaret, you know. He wants to talk to him. I didn't want to talk to him because I have a very good consultant that I put all my trust in.
Right.
And basically, over the course of the next number of months, he groomed my husband. We gave him 5,000 euros, which I got back before I went into hospital. The week before I went into hospital to have my bone marrow transplant and stem cell transplant. I suppose I felt very strongly about telling my story, which I did subsequently. And the reason I did that was not because I want to talk about myself publicly, which I don't. The problem was I was meeting and talking to people who didn't believe my story, didn't believe that DJ Carey was not honest and that he was. And the problem is I felt the only way I could do that was telling my sensational story, which it was. And once I did that, and that was out in the media, people began to believe and start to cooperate with the detectives. And started to realise, hang on, here we've got a problem.
But as John Cook noted, that in speaking out, Margaret had perhaps prevented others from losing money.
Can I say thank you for speaking to us on Liveline, but also thank you for speaking out on this as well, because it would appear that you and your husband, when you spoke out, when you spoke to journalists, including Emer, when you spoke to the Gardaí, it did help to bring this to a head and to put this case together as well, and to stop what was this deceit, the most reprehensible form of fraud, exploiting the good nature of people, as Judge Martin Nolan said. And you can be proud that you have done that as well, Margaret. Do you take some pride or comfort in that today, that you might have brought this to a head and stopped it?
To be honest with you, you know, we felt a moral obligation. I felt a moral obligation to do the right thing. And we were brought up, you know, in a family where you do the right thing.
Yes.
And that's all I did. I did nothing more. You know, and by giving him money in the first place, we did the right thing. Because I said to my husband, if we never get the money back, give it to him. The poor fecker needs it. And that's what we did. And that's what we continue to do. And that's what I want my kids to do. And that's the lesson for my family and for anybody. Just do the right thing. We did the right thing by DJ. You know, he's not a good guy. And for whatever reason, I don't even think about it, because I'm not going to give him any more of my headspace.
Margaret Kerwin on Liveline. and on coming home, stories of being Chinese Irish.
So let me see. I think it ding already the steamer. So let's check on the buns that we have steamed it there. Okay. So that's lotus buns. That's the lo mai guy. That's the first food I ate in London, where I was just screaming for. That's prawn dumplings.
Yummy prawn dumplings. That is Man Yin Chu. He was born in Hong Kong in 1981, but came to Ireland at the age of 6. He's now a chef and lives in Cabra in Dublin. But he remembered that when the family were settling in Dublin, they lived for a little bit of time over the takeaway.
And sometimes we'll come down and steal a chip here and there. Sometimes we sit out the counter and then just saying hi to customers and things like that, you know. We take an order here and there, you know, because we shout the order back in the kitchen. I think that's how you tell authentic Chinese takeaway, where the kitchen staff just doesn't speak a word of English. And the only one who speaks English is the child sitting in the counter.
From coming home. And more on language on Morning Ireland. Because if you're down with the kids, and if you're even saying that, you know you're really not. Words you need to know. Here's Cian with linguist Dr. Gail Flanagan from UL.
6-7. Not 67. 6-7. All over the country. Anyone that are your listeners will be rolling their eyes if they have Gen Alpha, if they have primary school children, because this is one of these expressions. It's nonsensical. It's gone viral. And it just means, yeah, whatever. Or it can mean whatever they want it to mean. I think it's some video out there that's gone viral since the summer. It can mean, it's kind of a reply like, how was school today? Well, 6-7, and a little smirk at the end. So they're okay. Enjoying it. Right. I've said
can you
it
use
to
it
my,
to say
my
goodbye?
I don't believe so, but you could. I mean, they okay. can use it in any, you know what I mean? Again, it's language evolving, and it's okay. especially our younger group using language to communicate with each other. Okay. If they decide tomorrow they want to say goodbye, they will.
Okay, well, I'll try it here. 6-7, Dr. Gail Flanagan. Thanks for joining us. It's now 8:57.
Oh, morning, Ireland. With Dermot, electrician turned comedian, turned electrician again, Chris Kent.
You went back to work. You went back to work as a spark.
That's right.
As an electrician during COVID, because you were feeling the squeeze. Performers were getting nothing during that time. And I guess you've had a lot of moments in your life, I would guess, where you're having that conversation, that little civil war in your head, or should I do the sensible thing, or should I keep pursuing this dream? How are you feeling in your head these days?
I'm very happy with my decision now, but I was also very happy with my decision then. There was no question at all. I wasn't too proud at all to pick up my tools again and, you know what I mean, blow off the 12 years of dust or whatever had gathered on them. I was nervous about
Which
it.
Which wire am I not meant to
exactly.
touch again?
No, that's the thing. I was nervous about it. Yeah. Unbelievably nervous, I would say. But also, I was far more nervous about not making money and not being able... We moved back from England after COVID. I was living in my childhood bedroom with my wife and kids, you know. I was fully aware at that point. It didn't feel like gigs were even coming back. So it wasn't... Mm-hmm. The nerves of going back to work were far outweighed by, what if I never get out of my childhood bedroom with my wife and kids? Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So I went back, and a couple of weeks into it, honestly, I was like, I'm actually good at this. It's a completely different brain, like, you know. I loved it, absolutely loved it. But eventually the time did come when the gigs came back, and
What were the other electricians like with you, knowing that you're a comic? Were they like, tell us a joke?
Yeah, there was a tiny bit of that, but just a tiny bit. People just want electricians to be electricians, I find. No one wants a funny electrician. No one wants like, this guy's hilarious. Yeah, but we had to move out because our house burned down, you know. No, people just want you to be an electrician. They're different hats, you know. I'd have a laugh with them in the canteen and I'd have a laugh with them elsewhere. But when it came to doing my work, I would be fairly serious about it.
Yeah. And you mentioned...
Don't even think about the slapstick. Now, coaxed out of retirement, Daniel Day-Lewis. And no finer programme than Arena bagged the interview. The film is Anemone and tells the story of two brothers trying to come to terms with the violence of their past and their time as soldiers in Northern Ireland. It's directed by Ronan Day-Lewis, which may have helped with the casting. Sinead Egan asked this question of Wicklow's Finest.
Was there a moment during the filming or during the shoot where you thought, yes, this is why I came back, this is what I love, this is what I've been missing?
I think really the entirety of it, quite honestly. I mean, even which included the writing process, which was sort of brand new to me. It was just a pure pleasure to be shoulder to shoulder with Ronan. We only ever wrote when we were in the same room together, which I think was a good decision. It took a bit longer to do because of that, but it was just, there was no, I don't think I ever stopped to think, I'm glad to be doing this again. I was just glad to be doing it again without even thinking about it. Yeah.
And then they took it onto set, which seems to have been a real pleasure for both father and son.
So to be on set together, I think, was just like a really, it was hard to kind of absorb how momentous it was to be able to work together in that way. But I think because we had had such a long gestation process of letting the script come together very organically over a few years, I realized in retrospect, once we were on set, that all that time had actually been preparation, because we'd had so many of these really detailed conversations about the character that otherwise maybe we wouldn't have had the chance to languish in for so long. So I think that was a huge gift, and made it so we had this shorthand on set.
Yeah, and I think that's always, if you can find your way to that, it's always a huge benefit if the talking can be over by the time you get, of course, you know, things arise that need to be dealt with, but for the most part, the talking is done with. And I did allow myself a sense of immense pride to see Ronan becoming a film director in front of my eyes. And we also allowed ourselves occasionally, you know, throughout the entire shoot, just like a shared moment of astonishment that we were being allowed to do this thing together. So,
yeah.
Daniel and Ronan Day-Lewis on Arena. Oh, Anna, that declaration of quitting the business back in 2017, possibly a little premature, or dare we say, dramatic.
I never stopped loving the work. I mean, that was perhaps a misapprehension, and I probably brought that on myself by opening my mouth, which I should have kept shut in the first place. But I never stopped loving the work. It's really, I've always wrestled over the years with I've been ill at ease with the sort of public aspect of the life, and never really grown used to it. And for some reason, that sort of reached a different level of intensity last time I worked.
You know what? He could put in a call to Kim Kardashian, because she's feeling the heat. She's in a new Ryan Murphy legal drama called All's Fair. Brutal seems to be the assessment. Fionnuala Jones joined the two.
The Irish Times is calling it stilted and preposterous. The Independent says the girl boss archetype has never been more embarrassing. And the Times says this may be the worst TV drama ever. Do you agree?
Yeah. I mean, well, I have eyes, Sarah. Really? So, yeah, I just watched it this afternoon. And I mean, there's a lot going on. You know what I mean? Look, I think the issue is it's Ryan Murphy as well. Ryan Murphy is a really particular style. And I think if you don't like that style, you're probably not going to be on board. Although I will say, when I saw the teaser initially, I was also intrigued. On paper, sounds interesting. You've got a really buzzy cast, really strong cast, like Glenn Close, Sarah Paulson, among others. It was absolutely excruciating. I just said on Instagram there, it felt like I was waking up from a coma, but like in a bad way. You know what I mean? Like it was really, the dialogue, abhorrent.
Well, I think, do you know what I think, Fionnuala? If, and I haven't seen this obviously, but if all the critics are against this, it's going to be a super hit.
But this is the thing. Everybody's chatting. I wasn't going to watch it, and then only for this piece. And because The Guardian giving it 0 stars, that's enough to kind of pique my intrigue to say, is it as bad as people are saying?
Would you watch it again now?
I'm kind of intrigued to see where they take the whole series, because obviously,
you got me back into the coma. Do you know what this is like? This is like Emily in Paris. It was so bad.
No, it wasn't.
No, it was so bad. It was good. And this
Emily
is exactly.
Paris is good.
I like, go girls, go female lawyers, and take on those dogs. That's what I say. I'd love to see how they do it.
Yeah.
Let's take a moment to relish the sound of the McInerney eyeball roll. Beautiful. And now to Kim.
I don't know how I feel about it. On the one hand, fair play to her for giving it a go, but also on the other hand, why?
Nothing Kim can do can be a career misstep because it's more exposure, more publicity, and people like you and Sarah, right, who are against her. Of course, you're a little bit jealous, maybe.
Furiously.
Every morning I wake up and I think, why am I not Kim?
I was actually drumming up my argument there. You pierced it completely. I have no question, Your Honour.
The 5 to the hour, Cormac and Sarah show. How we've loved it. Back in a bit. Welcome back.
The shops have gone from pumpkin to pine tree, and Mariah Carey has done her It's Time video. All of the Christmas arrival boxes are being checked. There are stacks of celebrations and hero tubs in the supermarkets. Higher than your head, they're back.
No. Well, not quite, but the dinner plans are taking shape for good or ill. With Brendan Courtney, no wiser souls than Alison and Ray. And they tackled this old chestnut.
Brother-in-law is the title on this email. Hi, Ray and Alison. I have a problem that pops up every year and I never seem to be able to resolve it. I have a brother-in-law who really doesn't make any effort with his family in any way. He has a girlfriend and both of them just take from their families and never do anything for them in return. They don't pay any attention to their nieces and nephews but always expect to be invited to all celebrations and events. They never bring gifts or sweets for the kids and never interact with them. All they do is give out about everything and never contribute positively to the family. It might sound a bit mean of me, but honestly, they really upset us, but we can't bring ourselves not to invite them over as their family and have no one else, no friends even. With Christmas coming, I'm once again dreading just giving in and inviting them over for the big Christmas dinner. He's my husband's brother, but he feels but my husband feels the same. He knows it's not fair that they get the royal treatment and don't appreciate any of it. But otherwise, they'd be left celebrating Christmas on their own. Any advice on how to handle it better for all of us? So, what do you do with that? I know what I'd do.
What would you do? Yeah.
I wouldn't invite them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, thanks. Yeah. I'm going to move on.
Oh, a silent scream outside the glass. Because A, you've got a show to fill. And B, well, is it really that simple?
There are ties to families, but they shouldn't be bonds. They shouldn't be binds that tie you down. It is a perfectly legitimate thing for you to turn around and kind of go, look, this Chris, just letting you know, and now's the time to do it, everybody. The beginning of November, flag with people. Yeah. I know I don't like seeing these ads stirring around, but definitely from a mental health point of view, mm-hmm. just that, look, we're going to do something different this year. We're having my parents down, or we're thinking about just to flag with you, just so that you can make another arrangement. Because I know every year, but just this year, we're going to flag it as a possibility. They will probably passive aggressively just wait and hold out until you make it definitive. But even to have that bit gives you a bit of wiggle room that you kind of go, we can do this. It's important to do this. Everyone deserves their own Christmas.
But for Alison, they might also deserve some straight talking.
I do think some people give a lot, and I do think that some people can take a lot. So I would say, if in this situation, I'd go back to the husband and say, would you speak to your brother?
Okay.
And like Ray's saying, I would be direct and honest and be mindful that sometimes I think within families' dynamics are accepted that actually are unacceptable.
Oh, really?
They are. Like, so, I mean, like everyone knows this, but no one's doing
saying it.
No one's saying it. And then the behaviour continues. So I think at this stage, you have nothing to lose, really. And to go back and I think it has to come from her husband because it's her brother. And just say, look, you know, we feel a bit uncomfortable. We've noticed that, you know, we host a lot and but I don't feel that it's a reciprocal relationship. We feel a little disappointed sometimes when you don't interact with the kids. It just feels a little bit like
one-sided.
And what do you think about that? Because honestly, and I know the sense, I know people might disagree with me, sometimes people don't even realise.
No, that's it as well.
Honestly,
I think you need to fire a shot over the bow. People deserve a chance, maybe.
I'm not saying they don't know, but there's a possibility. And it's interesting that in the relationship, both himself and the girlfriend kind of are acting in the same way. So just to kind of throw it out there, and then they have the clarity, and then they either change their behaviour or they don't. But I would put a boundary in that, like, this is about Christmas. It's about give and take.
Great advice. Basically, we all agree. Don't invite them. Okay.
Oh, good luck with that one. But let's park the C word for now. We're not there yet. It is still November. Sober up, people. You've got a month to give your liver a little bit of a detox. Here's Colm Tobin with Brendan.
Irish people are all fascinated by drink and not drinking and all that kind of thing. You say a very interesting thing. You talk about when you did drink, you don't drink now, that you talked a lot when you should have been listening all the time. That's fundamentally what drink makes us all do.
I was at a conference in Boston and the cream of Irish historians. I mean, you know, Diarmuid Ferger was there, Fergal McGarry, all the guys who had written the great stuff on the War of Independence in 1916. Yeah. And it was just one of those nights, you know, we all had done events and slightly high adrenaline.
Yeah,
and of course, the great thing adrenaline's looking for is a whole lot of pints and a whole lot of extras. You know, ended up going back to this other place where there was a lot of drink. And I just got high on the whole subject of everything. You know, there was nothing I didn't have a view of. I couldn't be stopped. You know, and the next day, one of the historians just said to someone, he was just too much. I went home. I mean, you know, imagine being the person who causes somebody in the middle of a party like that to go home. There might be something really wrong with you.
We've all been that sort of.
Yeah, but I mean, there's no excuse. The not drinking. If I had been quiet that night, I could have found out an awful lot of things I needed to know from these historians. Instead, like, I was telling them about Irish history. Do you know? Like, have you ever done that?
Of course. Yeah. So God, imagine the things we'd know if we had never taken a pint.
I'd wake in the night sometimes, shivering about all that.
Still.
Totally. That's why I wrote about it.
Yeah, and not a drop in 5, 6 years.
No more. 7 years and about 3 months, 4 months. Yeah.
Yeah, and you don't miss it.
Oh, I don't miss it at all. It's the best thing ever. I'm now worse than ever because I preach about this instead of telling historians about history. Yeah. I tell historians about sobriety.
Yeah, okay. Do you regret the
I do, everything. Years? Every pint, every drop ever taken, every penny spent, every hour wasted, I regret. I wish someone had...
Oh, my Lord. Further defence, please.
But like all of us shouting at each other, waiting for the other person to finish or butting in because we have something else to add to it all and everything. It's quintessentially part of being Irish, isn't it?
Yeah, it should stop.
Colm Tobin forcing us to rethink all those good nights out. But if he was all about the joys of sobriety, now to a woman who has made an entire career out of getting us all just a little bit on it with the fizzed up Lady Petrol on her Prosecco Express. Joanne McNally is now the biggest selling female comedian in the UK. She spoke to Miriam and when they met, have a listen.
Joanne, it's great to meet you.
I know, it's so lovely to meet you. I can't believe I haven't met you up to this point.
I know, me neither, but it's my pleasure. You're also incredibly tall and beautiful.
Oh, thanks so much. So are you.
No, but you actually are.
I'm going to do this for the whole thing. Bing, 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 bing.
It's a love-in, and they are the same height.
I must give small energy, I think, because Vogue is quite tall. But the thing that gets said to me most often by women who listen to the pod who haven't met me is, you're very tall. You're taller than I expected. Yeah. I'm 5'10". I'm a girthy 5'10".
Twin.
A twin, no less. Now, McNally was somewhat serious for this chat, and while her success has been massive, it was a while coming. And you might be surprised to learn some of the jobs she tried out.
I was desperate to do nursing. I actually worked as a carer in an Alzheimer's home for a couple of years when I was in university. Mm. But my mum was a nurse, she's retired now, and she was like, no! She was like, you're not doing that. And I was like, why? Because I just thought the camaraderie and all. And I loved, because I went to an all-female school, I kind of naively thought nursing was just a carry-on of that, except now you're maybe allowed to wear more eyeliner, do you know what I mean? Because you're a grown woman. But she was very against that idea because she feels nurses aren't respected enough.
Interesting.
But anyway, then I went in and I did the usual fannying around. And then I ended up working as a publicist in youth brands for a couple of years.
How was that?
I really liked it at the start. I was, as I've spoken publicly about before, I was kind of circling the plug hole of an eating disorder for a very long time. And then once I got into mainstream employment and realised this was my life and this was an adult, and I felt very unfulfilled by the whole thing. And then I just sort of went straight down the plug hole because it was almost something to do. I think I wanted to be successful at something, and then I didn't have the confidence to go into the writing. The acting I never did anything about the acting. I was quite suggestible. Anything to anyone, if I had an idea for something and someone would tell me, oh, I don't think you'll like that, I'd be like, okay, grand, well, what else will I do? I was just very suggestible. So then I just decided being thin would be, that would be my job. Mm. So that, and then I had to leave everything and I had to leave Pure and I had to go home to my mum's. And that's when I ended up getting into acting and comedy. It was all a very, very lucky, weird pivot.
And she talked about having to stop everything because of that eating disorder. Well worth a listen back. But given that a lot of her material online and with Vogue on the podcast concerns her love life, well, this was bound to come up.
I do think there's something shifting in the culture and there's more single, child-free women than ever before. And I was saying, I feel like marriage might become kind of the tramp stamp in years to come where we're like, I understood why you did it, but are you not getting removed? I don't know.
Yeah, because you're so happy the way you are. And I even thought twice about asking it to you, but you do talk about it a lot yourself. So
oh, yeah.
That's why I gave myself permission. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. But it's a huge part of my like shows and my comedy and all that jazz. But at the same time, I wake up with these existential crises at 3 a.m. and be like, oh my God, what happens when my mother passes away? And if my brother, you know, and you're on your own, I've all those concerns as well. Mm. And then I scroll on Hinge for an hour and then I ring one of my friends and I'm fine.
We were laughing before we went on air here and I was saying, maybe you need to go for steady edges like civil servants or accountants or engineers.
Do you know what's funny?
Because you're very funny about the dates you go on. They're the wrong guys.
I love dates. I love dates. They're so fun. But I also think I'm not, it's not my be all and end all. I was never going to be the kind of person who settled down early. I just don't have the attention span for it.
Why would you?
Because I think
you're doing so great.
I think a lot of women who are doing or are busy, like my mother was, she's kind of taking the mick out of me, but because I'm always saying I'm just so busy. But you could dissolve into your job for the rest of your life and wake up at 60 on your own, which I don't want to do. Mm. But when Taylor Swift got engaged, she sent me a link and she said, "Are you busier than Taylor Swift?" And I was like, "Wow."
That's
Patch
your
mom. Oh, mic drop, mammy. Joanne McNally with Miriam. And we can't leave it there because with the new book out, well, he had to.
From the mind of the woman who womans like no other woman. It's Miriam. Hi, I put pen to paper to talk about life, work, everything. The woman who tackles being a female person who's personal, a female human who's produced other humans, and a female who works and does everything as only a woman could. So many women say to me, Miriam, you pioneered being a woman. Thank you so much. And I blush and sashay away because I'm the busiest woman in the world. The memoirs feature the blow-by-blow tell-all story at last about the RTE scandal that hasn't had enough written about it. I knew something big was coming and it was about RTE. And I couldn't think of anything else that day while I was having a blow dry, planning dinner, writing my primetime notes with one hand, while composing poetry, defusing a bomb, handwriting a thank you note to Penny Lancaster with my own blood as I do with every guest on my radio show with the other. And as soon as word got out, I went straight to studio. Well, not straight. First, I had to change a head gasket on the car and perform 12 photo shoots. I really can do everything.
Not in the least awkward in the RTE canteen next week. And that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.